A grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Illinois State Geological Survey Centennial Lecture Series. At 4:30 p.m. on Thursday, February 9th, in the Beckman Center Auditorium on the U of I campus, the Illinois Geological Survey is presenting a public lecture and panel discussion titled The Evolving Role of Earth Science in Making Public Policy by U.S. Geological Survey Director F. Patrick Leahy and Texas State Geologist Scott W. Tinker.
This is WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. This is listener supported WILL, and this is our February membership campaign. Thanks for tuning in, and we would like to thank those of you who have joined us this week with a pledge of financial support. You know, it's through campaigns like this that we find the contributors and the dollars we need to keep programs like the Afternoon Magazine on the air. By the end of the day today, we're hoping to reach $40,000, and as of now, we have raised $33,000 towards reaching that goal. So thanks to those of you who have called in and who have become members of the Friends of WILL or renewed your membership. You can help out if you haven't already by giving us a call. Call our pledge center. Here is the number, 217-244-9455-244-WILL. Joining me now from Pledge Central is Maeve Riley. She is the editor of our program guide, Patterns. Hi, Maeve.
Hi, Celeste.
We're going to talk with an editor in this hour of the program.
One of the unsung heroes of the world. I just want to say I'm so excited to listen to this hour.
Yeah, well, editors are wonderful people because they can make you look so good.
That's a goal, yeah.
Yeah,
that's we try our best, yes.
Yeah. Okay, but in the meantime here, before we get to our guest this afternoon, Katja Rice, we want to inspire people.
That's right.
To get to the telephone and make a pledge of financial support.
And we've been talking about $40, which is our basic membership level, which entitles you to a year's worth of Patterns. You'll get our monthly program guide during the year. But also, if you give a pledge at the $75 level or above, you'll receive our member card, which is a nice way, another way to say thank you for supporting WILL. You get 2-for-1 dining in a lot of area restaurants, some free admissions to some, you know, activities around. So that's another way, an incentive for us to get you to pledge your support. 217-244-9455 is the number to call. Celeste, you and I were talking during the break about the matching companies, too. Mm-hmm. And about $50,000 of the money we receive each year comes from businesses who are helping their employees along in their donations to not-for-profit groups. Places like ADM, State Farm, and Tate & Lyle will match employees' donations to not-for-profit. So that's an extra way. You know, it's a nice thing for your mm-hmm. company to do. It's also an extra way for your money goes a little bit further that way, too.
Yeah, you can give more without taking it right from your own wallet.
Right.
So make that gift go further, farther. Ooh, am I in trouble now?
We'll ask the other editor.
Okay, that's a question for our guest coming up. So you can check that out, and you might be eligible for a corporate match. That would be terrific. The number to call with a pledge of financial support, 244-9455. That's 244-WILL. Maeve, we'll talk with you a little bit later this afternoon. We'll get the answer to that question farther or further, okay? Sounds good. This is the Afternoon Magazine. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. The English language contains a great many words. It might have more words than any other language, so it can be a challenge to find the right word or words. Further, farther. On the program today, I invite your questions about grammar, pronunciation, and the meaning of words. Our guest is Katja Rice. She served as the copy editor for the New English Usage Dictionary, Right, Wrong, and risky. Right, Wrong, and Risky, a dictionary of today's American English usage, was compiled by Mark Davidson. He taught communications at the University of California at Los Angeles and the University of Southern California. Katya Rice is a freelance copy editor. She was Davidson's copy editor. She has worked as a copy editor on many books, including several on language. She's edited all kinds of books, novels, children's books, cookbooks, nonfiction, and poetry. Among the authors for whom she served as copy editor, Steven Pinker, Jeffrey Nunberg, and Calvin Trillin. Listeners, if you have a question about English language usage, we'd love to hear from you. Katya Rice is at the ready. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. If you're looking for a usage dictionary, you might want to take a look at Right, Wrong, and Risky, a dictionary of today's American English usage by Mark Davidson. The publisher is W.W. Norton. 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Katya Rice, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me on.
My conundrum there, farther, further.
Well, I'm going to read to you what Mark Davidson said about it in his book. It's a tough one to come up with off the top of one's head.
Yeah.
let me read to you. It's a brief entry. As two forms of the comparative degree of the adjective and adverb far, the words farther and further are commonly used interchangeably. But usagists are unanimous in asking you to use the far word, farther, for physical distance, as in moving farther from his office, and to use further for non-physical distance, as in moving further from his principles.
Okay.
So we have to go back to your sentence and think about how you used it, and why don't you tell me which one you think it was?
I think I would select now further.
I would as well. Although the nice thing about being a copy editor on a manuscript is that I have a lot of time to think about it and, you know, can check various guides and see what the consensus is. When you're talking, it's much harder to come up with the right word in every case. I was listening earlier to your talk with Deborah Tannen on Tuesday, which was just terrific, and heard her say that relationships between mothers and daughters evolve continually. Now, continually versus continuously is an interesting problem.
Mm-hmm.
Continuously is correctly used for something that is more like a stream of water flowing, something that's changing all along. Continually is more like an episodic change. You have an episode of change and then later another episode. But the interesting thing about what Deborah said is that it really could be either. With something like evolving, I tend to think continuously is the right word because you cannot necessarily pinpoint the moments of change. But some people's experience would say that actually there are particular moments of change, and that it's not necessarily continuous. It's an interesting example of the kind of choice that we sometimes make one way and we sometimes make another way.
Yeah. Well, in that example, I'm thinking of relationship can be like a hallway, and there are rooms off the hallway where you may pause. So those two words work well, I think, either one of them. You can select either one of them.
Yes. I think if you're talking about, say, historical evolution of a species, you would say you would probably choose the word continuously, even though, again, there are moments when there's a mutation or something that later, you know, results in a changed, or in a new species. But I don't think you think of it as rooms. You think of it as kind of staying in the hallway, unless you know exactly what those rooms are, and could walk into them again. You would probably choose continuously.
Yeah. How did you get your start as a copy editor?
Well, I used to be a typesetter. After I got through college, I was working at the University of North Carolina Press, and I used to write snippy little remarks in the margins of the galleys that I was typesetting. and finally, the editors sat up and noticed me and said, you know, if you're so smart, why don't you try this? Now, I should say, in a way, I had started earlier. When I was a kid, I used to make little books. I remember when I was, about seven, maybe eight, my older sister was nine. Our younger sister was just learning to read. And we decided that it would be fun to make a book in which we used only the short E and short I sounds. My sister's name was Jenny. So we wrote a book called Jenny Lives in the Pig Pen with Jill. and we discovered it was very hard to avoid the word and, but I think we managed to. But I had always loved words and loved books, loved the physical object of the book, also loved listening to people talk, and am fascinated by little things I learn along the way. For instance, when I edited Steven Pinker, one of the things I learned, it was a small thing, but it was fascinating to me, that you can say, I gave a painting to the museum, or I donated a painting to the museum. But if you want to get rid of the word to, you can say, I gave the museum a painting, making the museum an indirect object there. But you cannot say, I donated the museum a painting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we know how to do that properly. You don't often hear people saying things like, I donated the museum a painting, because we all pick up along the way some sense of how to use words. But occasionally we goof, and, I wanted to be someone who would find out how language worked and be able to, you know, tell people when they goofed. So, but also to fast forward a little bit into how I got into it after I started doing manuscripts for University of North Carolina Press. Each manuscript is a new challenge. It takes a while before you suddenly say, you know, I know how to approach this. And it's really not a matter of imposing your own views on language on an author. To some degree, of course, you want to say this is right and this is not right and we should change it. But the longer you do it, the more you think that there are lots of ambiguous situations. And it's really a matter of finding out how the author is thinking about it. I mean, and especially when you edit, say, a novel, you don't want to have children being extremely careful about how they use the word like. Children say, for instance, I did it like my mother told me to. They don't say, I did it as my mother told me to, even if that's correct. But you might want to suggest, in some cases, when the child is supposed to sound well-educated, you might want to say, you know, maybe this child could say, I did it the way my mother told me to, which is a way to kind of sidestep the ungrammatical like without going with the pedantic, you know, awkward sounding as.
Yeah.
So decisions of that kind come up often.
Yeah. Now you're working with the manuscript, but you're also working with another human being, the writer, the author.
That's right.
So how does that work?
Well, in the case of this book, it was a very interesting dialogue between Mark and me. Mark had taught writing for a long time. He had never worked as an editor. And I realized that our perspectives were in some ways different, in ways that I thought would be useful for the book, for accuracy, but also for including examples that would be useful to editors as well as to writers. So we often came up with something together. For instance, for his entry on misspellings of the word renown. He has an interesting entry on renown and renowned. I think he starts off by explaining that renown is the noun and renowned is the adjective. People often make that mistake, he said. But he had seen a misspelling of the word renown in an antique store in San Diego, talking about, Wyatt Earp, the renown something or other. And he, it was spelled R-E-N-O-U-N. So, or R-E-N-O-U-N-E-D. So I said to Mark, it's a great example, but I tend to see it with a K. In fact, as an editor, I find myself looking this word up. It's one of the very few words that make me nervous every time I see it, R-E-N-O-W-N. I know that's right, but I simply cannot make myself remember it. Anyway, so I said, I really would like to put in here this spelling with a K as a misspelling. And Mark said, I just have never seen that. And I said, well, let me, go on Google News here. And we came up with 30 printed 30 uses of renowned with a K in the past 30 days in, reputable publications. So we realized, I think he realized that I was right, that it's out there. He happened not to have seen it, but it's something that distresses many copy editors. It distresses us in the sense that we're not absolutely sure, and things we're not sure about tend to make us kind of nervous when it's something as straightforward as spelling. So we did put in my perspective on that. I felt that there were some other entries that I needed to have needed to express my own views in a bit. He had an interesting entry, for instance, on the expression or the phrase one of those. There's a problem with singular and plural. For instance, if you write, he has a quote here from the New Yorker, top thrill dragster is one of a new generation of roller coasters that generate their own publicity by setting world records. Now, some people think that you would say one of a new generation that generates its own publicity by setting a world record. They get anxious. There are lots of examples. Let me see if I can find you something else. He is one of those dads who spend time in the park with their children. Some people think it sounds better. He is one of those dads who spends time in the park with his children and get very anxious about it. Now, the thing that was interesting about Mark's entry is I realized that actually he had some sentences where he had gotten it wrong. So, it's very hard not to occasionally get it wrong.
Well, thank goodness.
Yes. So I decided to add the sentence that he had originally gotten wrong, making it correct, of course, but I just thought it was a very nice example. So we said, the octopi or octopus's entry in this book begins with the question, are you one of those people who carefully avoid referring to more than one member of the octopus family. I can't remember how the sentence continued. And then he explains, the suggestion here is that there are many people in this category, people who avoid referring to the plural form of octopus, and the sentence asks you whether you are one of them. The verb avoid has the plural subject people, not the singular subject one. So again, are you one of those people who carefully avoid, where the number of avoid is governed by the plural people rather than by the singular one? And then, because I found this so fascinating, I said, you know, Mark, how about let's put in something about an exception to the pattern. And so this paragraph was something we came up with together. But here is another example, one that seems at first to be an exception to this pattern. It is correct to say, Jerry is the only one of the men I know who loves to cook. Not who love to cook. The reason for the singular verb loves becomes clear when the sentence is turned around. Of the men I know, Jerry is the only one who loves to cook. Hmm. In this case, Jerry is not being included in a category. He is not a member of a group of men who love to cook. Rather, he is being singled out. He is the one man I know who loves to cook.
Hmm.
So it was, in many ways, as I say, a bit of a collaborative process. Of course, the entries we included were ones that Mark felt would be especially useful for students, people, you know, he knew who people with whom he'd worked who needed a book like this. And so there were things, you know, that I would have loved to include, but frankly, things that are so complicated, I'm not quite sure what we would have said.
Yeah. Well, he says in the, he wrote in the, early in the book that, and this is something that you've kind of alluded to a couple of times now, is the wonder of language in that we might not know exactly what we're doing, but we can do it. And he says something like, you know, you can use the language, it's like driving a car.
Yeah.
You don't need to know what's under the hood, but you better know the steering wheel from the gas pedal, something like that.
Right. Well, and that's a somewhat thorny issue because for linguists, grammar means, you know, the way language works, and it doesn't mean picky little things like, is it okay to split an infinitive? And, you know, we're all born being able to learn language and to use language in very interesting ways. So we're not, and correct ways. We're not tempted to say things like the run, store, the to boy or so, you know, rather than the boy runs to the store. I mean, we know how to string words together surprisingly quickly and correctly, and, you know, it's really quite an accomplishment. So we don't always get it right, you know, between you and me versus between you and I. And although it is a copy editor's job to explain that to an author, I think sometimes we go too far in trying to correct things that are perfectly clear. So I'm going to shock people by saying that I've been known to leave something like me and Jennifer went to the mall in a manuscript, especially when it's a kid talking in a novel. I don't actually leave Jennifer and me went to the mall, because if you listen carefully to people, they're tempted to use me only when it's first. At least that's my general sense of things. And I think linguists have theories about why that is. You know, especially if you want to represent speech as you actually hear it, I think you want to be careful about saying, you know, people just don't you're revealing your character as a completely ignorant person if you say this. Because actually, I heard an adult with a PhD say essentially me and Jennifer went to the mall last week. So I also heard someone saying, oh, this was great on the radio. First she said, my father raised my sister and I, which of course, you know, grammarians say that needs to be my sister and me, because me is an object of the verb raised. But we don't, raised my sister and I doesn't sound that funny to us anymore. But then in the next sentence she said, I remember my mother brushing my sister and I's hair. And I thought, well, that's where you end up if you do accept my father raised my sister and I. Mm-hmm. You may end up with I remember my mother brushing my sister and I's hair. But honestly, it's a tough construction. I remember my mother brushing my sister's and my hair, or I remember my mother brushing our hair, my sister's and mine. Mm. Or I remember my mother brushing my hair and my sister's. I mean, I can think of about three ways to say it that actually sound better than my sister's and my hair.
Yeah. Although when it's on paper, that's more critical.
Yes.
In conversation, it goes by so quickly. You just have to be tuned in and try to. I guess you could use the word decode.
Right.
What's happening?
That's true. There are many things you hear that are not actually a problem, and you know some of it is the tone of voice in which it's said. I mean, linguists use the example of "I couldn't care less" and "I could care less," where "I couldn't care less" is the logical thing to say. And actually, I think this is something, you know, Mark feels strongly about, that we need to stick with "I couldn't care less." But when people say it aloud, linguists have done studies of the tone of voice when people say, "I could care less," and it's a different stress pattern. So, but still, it's jarring to me when I see "I could care less" in print, mm-hmm. because it doesn't have that tone traveling with it, as it were.
Yeah.
So it becomes harder for me to accept when it's written. I also heard, actually, I'm very simplistic with my jewelry the other day, which I thought was an interesting thing to say. What she was trying to say is I choose, you know, I don't like to wear anything too fancy. The problem with simplistic used that way is it means, let's see how Mark explains what it means. I think he does have an entry on it.
Well, you look that up. I'll reintroduce you.
Okay.
Our guest this afternoon is Katya Rice. She served as the copy editor for the New English Usage Dictionary, Right, Wrong, and Risky, a dictionary of today's American English usage, which was compiled by Mark Davidson. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, your questions about grammar, pronunciation, the meaning of words, language are invited this afternoon. Give us a call. Join the discussion, 333-9455, the number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. Now to simplistic.
Yes. So Mark explains that the word simplistic means overly simplified. Now he is concerned about the phrase too simplistic, which you see is redundant,
mm-hmm.
because it means mm-hmm. overly simplified. Anyway, he further explains that simplistic is derived from the little-used noun simplism, which dictionaries define as an act of oversimplification that ignores important details. Now, I think that's the crucial part here, that, you know, if you say something is simplistic, you're including the idea that important details are being left out. So it's actually a word with somewhat negative connotations.
Mm-hmm.
unlike simple, which, you know, we like to keep things simple. That's nice. So when she says, I'm very simplistic with my jewelry, it's a bit of a mismatch, a mishmash with a kind of a mixed message, I think.
Yeah. Although you can understand why that happens, and there are other words that we confuse as well. And I'm going to give an example of that here, and then we're going to talk to some listeners who are waiting to talk with you, Katya. I once heard someone say, that is a very eloquent gown.
Yes.
And that's, you can see how that's so easy to make that error.
Yes. Well, let me just say very quickly, I think we have associations in our head that lead to all kinds of mistakes. So actually, the renown example, if I could just say quickly, I think the reason people insert a K is they have a feeling that it has something to do with knowing someone being well-known.
Right.
And when my son was three, I remember he used to call the railing along a stairway, a banister, he called it a banister, which I thought was a wonderful word.
Right.
Obviously, he came up with it because he associated it with stairs.
Mm-hmm.
So it made a lot of sense. It happens not to be the right word, but it should be the word.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with some listeners. We've got phone lines are all lit up here. Let's first go to a listener in Urbana waiting for us on line one. Hi.
Hi. I think it's interesting to, I just love talking about words and what they mean, and et cetera. And I find it really interesting when you have a collision between English speakers from different parts of the world.
Yes.
An example is the word homey.
Uh-huh.
No, homely. Homely. I saw it in an advertisement for an apartment or a hotel room in somewhere in India, and I realized that what they were trying to say was that it was, I would have said homey, but I interpret the word homely as being very plain.
Yes.
So you have to be careful what context you're in. But the thing that I'm noticing, and the reason I was calling, was I've noticed a lot in various written sources, usually it's not stuff that's copy-edited, it is a misuse of the plural, where people put an apostrophe S instead of just sticking an S on a word where it should be. So they turn it into a possessive instead of a plural. And I'm curious, it just seems to suddenly have happened in the last couple of years. I'm just noticing it more and more. I'm curious as to how this kind of thing gets going.
You know, I don't know with that thing in particular. I know that it's one of the things that Lynn Truss was especially concerned about in her book, Eats, Shoots, and Leaves. But at which, unfortunately, I still haven't gotten around to reading. Copy editors were a little upset that her subtitle, A Zero Tolerance Approach to Punctuation, didn't have a hyphen in zero tolerance. But I think with something like that, if you do start seeing it, it's very hard not to start using it. And I mean, I was thinking about misuses of who and whom, for instance. It's very hard to use whom correctly these days. We engage in a, you know, what linguists call hypercorrection, which is a process by which we reach for what we think is the correct version. You know, we know there's some problem where people misuse who, where they use who, where they should use whom. And so we start thinking whom would be correct any old place. So we get examples like, I should find one for you. I saw this in a movie review in the Los Angeles Times. I'll be sending thank you notes to whomever it was that managed to avoid mentioning something rather. I forget what she said. Now, this is an extremely tough one because after two, you would reach for whomever rather than whoever. But in fact, I think if you analyze the sentence, it should be whoever, because it's the subject of the clause, whoever managed to avoid something or other. Or here's another example from Copy Editor Newsletter, which got it right. Learn to give more attention to the stories from reporters who you know make more mistakes than others. It's not actually reporters whom you know. It's from reporters who, and then a parenthetical, you know, make more mistakes than others. So the crucial clause there is who make more mistakes than others. But we're so used to wanting to be correct, and you know that I think most people would reach for whom there. It's really only because this was in Copy Editor Newsletter that this was correct. But I think I've strayed a little far from your question.
Well, that's okay. I think you've got the basic idea. It's probably what is going on. Who knows?
Yeah.
Well, language changes, and it's a very elastic thing, and something that once upon a time was unacceptable becomes acceptable. And before we go on to the next call, I guess the question here would be, when do you know it's okay? When do you know it's not risky?
That is very tough. I myself am beginning to feel that there are certain things we should not worry about anymore. For instance, the misuse of hopefully, or the supposed misuse of hopefully as a sentence adverb. One thing you can do to see how far we should be going with things that seem to be changing, you know, is it okay to just accept them finally? You can do things like look in the American Heritage Dictionary at the usage notes. Whenever the American Heritage Dictionary comes out with a new edition, the usage notes change. And the usage panel is a panel of, I think, about 200 writers and other people who use language, journalists, linguists, editors. And they will tell you whether they think it's okay to say, hopefully it will rain tomorrow. Or whether we need to reserve hopefully in a hopeful manner, as in, you know, she hopefully turned in her paper. That one's ambiguous, but it's hard to think of a use, actually, of hopefully the way some grammarians say we're supposed to use hopefully. It's much more natural to use hopefully in the way that is supposedly incorrect. And I think that the dictionary has gone in the direction of saying, look, you know, this is now acceptable to a much higher percentage than it was 15 years ago. And, you know, maybe we should give up on this. It really serves mostly to distinguish between people who are well-educated and people who aren't. There's no clarity issue. I guess I should say I think there are distinctions between words that are worth holding on to. For instance, disinterested and uninterested, where disinterested has the lovely meaning of impartial. You want someone to be you want a judge to be disinterested, to not have a personal financial interest in something. You don't want a judge to be uninterested in a case.
Yeah.
And that's a lovely distinction to preserve.
Yeah.
Now, I think Mark advises us to use impartial if it's important to be clear. Because, you know, people do not necessarily know anymore that disinterested doesn't mean the same thing. And so, you know, we might want to take that safer path.
Okay.
I think one nice thing about Mark's book is he does lay out the risks. You know, you can use beg the question correctly, but 2% of the population will have any idea of what you're talking about. Because, you know, really 98% of the uses these days have to do with raising the question or avoiding the question. And, you know, beg the question doesn't mean either of those things. But what it does mean is now so hard to explain. You really almost never see it. You never see it used correctly. And I think it's not that I think we have to accept raise the question, you know, beg the question where it should be raise the question, because there's this perfectly good alternative. Why not say, well, that raises the question,
yeah,
such and such. But if we're going to use it, we're going to have to give people some help. If we're going to use it correctly, we're going to have to give people some help in understanding what it means.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hi. I've come across a recently come across a usage that is really disconcerting, and it's interesting the way it's come about. My sister-in-law from way southern Illinois uses the phrase "I don't care to," mm-hmm, to mean "I don't mind."
Yeah.
And so when she says "I don't care to go to the grocery store if you need me to get something for you," it sounds like she's saying no,
yes,
rather than "I'd really, you know, I'd like to do this for you."
Yes.
And it's—I don't know where it's come from, but it's fairly frequently used in that part of Illinois that I've become familiar with, and I don't know if it's common anyplace else. But
you know, I know that I have heard that, and it's interesting. I wonder if it is a regionalism, or in some cases, you get parallel, you get two different meanings of a word being passed down and then kind of going in two directions. I mean, it's hard to describe what I mean, but I think with the phrase, for instance, the gauntlet and the gantlet, running,
yes,
the gantlet or running the gauntlet,
mm-hmm,
apparently both are correct, but with different derivations. I think Mark has an entry on that. I won't look it up now, but what was interesting to me is that that sometimes when you go way back in a word's history, you get, or in the history of two words, you get meanings that, as with interest, disinterest and uninterest,
mm-hmm,
one of them is picking up on one sense of interest and one of them is picking up on another sense of interest.
Nice.
And so, you know, both exist. It seems as if they would be synonyms because dis and un more or less mean the same thing in some other words. But in fact, you know, one of them is using one of the senses of a word and the other one is using another of the senses of the word. So it's an interesting,
yeah,
phenomenon.
It's just real strange because every time she says it, it's so jarring in
yes,
the context that I have to stop a minute and translate.
Yes.
Thank you.
I think my husband says something like that. I'm trying to remember what it is, but every time I hear it, I think, what? So.
Well, you know what? We're out of time.
My goodness.
Yeah, maybe you would come back and we would do this again because we had some other folks that wanted to talk with you and we're just out of time.
Well, I'm sorry that we didn't get to the other questions.
Yeah.
I start to talk and I go wild.
That's okay. It's fun getting under the hood with you with language. And I want to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. And let's make a date for another time and when we're not in the midst of a fun drive and we'll have the entire... You know, we'll have several extra minutes to talk.
That sounds terrific.
Okay. Katja Rice, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste.
Katja Rice served as the copy editor for the New English Usage Dictionary, Right, Wrong, and Risky, a dictionary of today's American English usage compiled by Mark Davidson, the publisher of the book W.W. Norton. I'm Celeste Quinn. Maeve Riley, editor of Patterns Magazine, is in Pledge Central this afternoon with me here on the afternoon magazine. She's in Pledge Central. I'm in the studio. And there's the answer. Maeve, if you work for a company that will do a corporate match, your pledge will go further.
Further. Good, yes. I went back and checked in Strunk and White, too, just so I would make sure I had the right answer in my head when I came back. So, yes, it will go further if you make a pledge. If you work for a company that will match your pledge to WILL, all you have to do is go to your human resources department, I think, and fill out a form. But you'll have to make the pledge first, and you can do that by calling 217-244-9455. If you make a pledge at the $40 level, you become a friend of WILL and will receive Patterns, our monthly program guide.
And
so
Patterns,
thank you, Gift.
Patterns contains information about not only what you can tune into here on AM 580, but also our FM station, WILL-FM, and our television station, WILL-TV. The number to call, 244-9455. That's 244-WILL. You can also join online at willpledge.org. It is 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade, an interesting day after USDA releasing the World Agricultural and Supply Demand Estimates early this morning. Beans now for the carryout, 555 million bushels. Corn at 2.401 billion. The corn's down about 25 million bushels from the January estimate released by USDA. And the beans are up 50 million. They're up on the top end of their range, by the way. What that means for those of you who don't have an idea what a WASDE number is, it's a World Agricultural Supply Demand Estimate. And basically those numbers say how much will we have left in the bin when the next harvest season rolls around. So this coming fall, how many beans will be left? 555 million is their current estimate, and that's the largest number on hand. So that's like having a whole lot of meat in your freezer and potentially no place or no way to use it all so quickly. And usually that means the price of something's going to go down. Not the case in Chicago today, where futures rallied in the bean pit. They were up about 10.5 cents today in the maize, and the November contract up 11 cents. We'll talk about those this afternoon with Dan Zwicker of AgriVisor Services out of Bloomington, Illinois. We'll talk about the wheat pit as well in Kansas City today. The hard red winter wheat rallied 7 cents. It had a high today of 436, a low at 425, a settlement price there at 433 and 3 quarters. They were up 7. July's a 431 high, low at 422. And a settlement price at 429 and a quarter. They were a nickel higher for the day from Chicago. The July wheat at 365 high, low at 356. Settlement price at 363 and a quarter, up 6.5 cents. In the May, 376, the high, the low at 367.5. Their settlement at 374 and three quarters. They were up 6 cents for the day. July contract at 385 high, low at 377. Settlement price at 384, up 6. In September's 395, the high, the low at 386 and three quarters. Settled at 394 and a quarter, up 7 and a quarter. December futures in the wheat pit, 406, the high, the low at 399. Settlement price at 404 and a half for the December wheat. It finished a nickel higher today. We read the Kansas City and the July and the Chicago wheat numbers because they do have an impact on the corn numbers. And we don't read the Minneapolis Grain Exchange, but we may bring that into the conversation a little later today, because if we continue to have the dry, hot weather in the Southwest and the Kansas City hard red winter wheat numbers actually go down in terms of yield, a lot of that comes out of Texas and the Great Plains states. It's very dry there. That might mean that the folks up in Minneapolis and Minnesota might see an opportunity, because the price of wheat is higher, to plant more spring wheat acres. And then you start a shift, a kind of a domino effect. What happens to the rest of the acreage around the globe? So here we go. Corn pit now. March contract, 226.5 the high. Low at 221.5 in the corn pit, and a settlement price at 225.5, up 4.25. May futures, 236 and three quarters the high, the low at 31 and three quarters. Settlement price at 236 and a quarter, up 4.25. In July contract, 245 and a quarter the high, low at 240.5. Settlement price at 244 and three quarters, up 4.5 cents. September's 252 the high, the low at 48. Settlement price at 250 and three quarters. They were up 4 cents for the day. December contract, 261 and a quarter the high, the low at 257 and a quarter. Settled at 260 and three quarters, up 4.25. The March contract at 267, the high, the low at 63. Settlement price at 66, up 3 and three quarters. You're saying, Todd, why on the corn pit then? Because if they've got more spring wheat acres, they're either taking corn or soybeans out of production, but you're not including the possibility of putting sorghum into Texas, which can be a replacement for corn. March corn, or March oats now, 195.5 the high. Low at 188.5, a settlement price at 193. They're up a penny and a half. The May futures at 192. They're up 1.75. I learned all that from Daryl Good this morning, by the way. He's an ag economist here at the U of I. We'll talk to him during the closing market report, too. March soybeans, 594. The high, the low at 579. Settlement price at 587.75, up 9.75. May futures, 607. The high, the low at 591.75. Settlement price there at 601.75, up 10.5 cents. July contract now 617 the high, low at 602. July beans settled 610.25. They were up 7.75 in the August. 616 the high, the low at 07. Settlement price at 614, up 9.5 cents in the November beans. 630 the high, the low at 615. Settlement price there at 625. They were up 11 for the day. The Jans at 629 at the end of this day for 2007. That bean contract, 9.5 cents higher. Bean meal now, 183.80 the high, the low at 180. Settlement price at 181.60, up $1.40. The May contract up $1.10 at 183.70. And the March bean oil, settlement price at 22.65. They were up 50 cents, 22.75 the high, the low at 22.12. And the May futures, 23.15 the high, the low at 22.52. Settlement price there at 23.08, and they finished 50 higher. I'll be back at 6 after the hour, 2 o'clock. My name's Todd Gleason, the Mercantile Exchange numbers, in just a moment.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Livestock contracts finished higher today. March feeder cattle, the high 109.25, the low 108 even, the settlement 108.85, that up 87.5. April 110.05, the high 108.95, the low, the settlement 109.82.5, that up 80. May feeder cattle 110.50, the high 109.40, the low, the settlement 110.42.5, that up 85. February live cattle 92.30, the high 91.25, the low 92.25, the settlement, that up 52.5. April live cattle 90.50, the high 89.55, the low 90.15, the settlement, that up 20. February lean hogs 57.65, the high 57.20, the low, the settlement 57.62.5, that up 27.5. April lean hogs 62.32.5, the high 61.60, the low 62.22.5, the settlement, that contract up 1 nickel. April, we've just finished April. May, lean hogs, 67.40, the high, 66.75, the low. The settlement, 67.40, that up 2.5. June, lean hogs, 69.50, the high, 68.80, the low, finishing at 69.47.5, that 12.5 cents higher on the day. And February pork belly, 78.60, the high, 77.20, the low. The settlement, 77.85, that up 10. The Dow is up 55 points at 10,913. The NASDAQ 3 higher at 2270. The S&P 500 up 3 at 1270.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg,